For Crowley, who was now referring to himself as the Beast 666, the Golden Dawn turned out to be a bitter disappointment. He thought that they were playing at magic and tried to take the society over. He clashed with the poet W.B. Yeats, who was a prominent member, calling him a lank, disheveled demonologist.
This was the real major step for Crowley, when he thought that he was leaving behind the Golden Dawn and all its sort of milk and water magic and moving into the world of sort of real magic. And he was perfectly willing to take on black magic. He was willing to use any forces that he possibly could, that he could control.
Crowley decided to perform the Abra Melon, a black magic ritual that no magician had dared undertake for centuries.
Crowley's so dedicated to performing the Abra Melon ritual that he actually goes to the length of seeking out and finding the perfect place and buying a house to do the actual ritual in. Nothing else, just actually to do this ritual. And it's in Loch Ness, Beleskin House. This is such an extreme thing to do. This is not a game. He's trying to break down, he's trying to push further than anyone else has been before. At the moment, his yardstick is the Golden Dawn, so he's already shattering that completely.
The Abra Melon dates back to the 14th century. The aim of the six-month ritual is to master demons, but it was considered extremely dangerous. If the ritual went wrong, it was believed that evil spirits could be set loose and take possession of the magician.
The Abra Melon ceremony has an introduction which states that nobody should perform this ceremony. Red rag to a bull with Alistair. Crowley, at a time when he did it, had a lot of determination to delve as deeply as he could into the occult. He certainly did do partially the Abra Melon ceremony in the house, which is to do with conjuring up one's guardian angel. But in order to do that, you've got to release a lot of other spirits of one sort or another. Even in broad daylight, the room he was working in became almost pitch dark, and he had to light candles and this sort of thing to continue what he was about.
Deep mouth from their thrones deep seated, the choirs of the eons declare the last of the demons, the kingdom is thine to inherit.
The man, actually, I don't think, mixed a great deal with the locals, but they knew what he was about. Crowley never made any secrets about the sort of individual that he was. And the north of Scotland being the way it is, there's still some sort of healthy superstitions floating about. And, yeah, I mean, there were some people who wouldn't even walk past this place. I have a healthy respect for what the occult can do and how it can really muck up your life.
Crowley, in his absolutely typical way, broke off the ritual. He just couldn't be bothered to go on, because it really is pretty exhausting, you know, living on bread and water and getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning with invocations and all kinds of things. It's nothing so much as like being a monk, only harder. And so Crowley gave it up. If you do that kind of thing, you get possessed, in a certain sense. Things get inside you and use you for their purposes.
It was at this point that Crowley met Rose Kelly, a young society lady. Courting scandal, he married her the day after they met and took her off to Egypt for their honeymoon, leaving the Abra Melon ritual unfinished.
The honeymoon was a period of uninterrupted debauchery. Once in the first 3 weeks or so, Rose took some trifling liberty. I recognized the symptoms and turned her up and spanked her. She henceforth added the qualities of a perfect wife to those of a perfect mistress.
When I was in my late teens, Crowley's like an inspiration. He was somebody who was living a life that you wanted to live like. You wanted to be able to do what you wanted, you know, break down the taboos, break down the barriers. And there was somebody that had already done it, so they sort of become your own sort of personal guru.
We're at the Great Pyramid now. This is where Crowley and his wife came on their honeymoon. And one night, they decide to spend a night inside the king's chamber. This is just for Crowley really to show off and show what a great magician he is to his wife. They must have done this on their own, him and Rose. Must have been quite an eerie thing to do. This is it. This is the king's chamber.
I wanted my wife to see what a great magician I was. We went accordingly after dinner with candles. I had with me a small notebook in which was written the preliminary invocation of the Goetia.
The Goetia is a grimoire. It's probably the closest thing to a black magic book. It's the Lesser Key of Solomon. It's got nothing to do with invoking angels. It's got nothing to do with anything particularly spiritual. It's purely to raise demons and nothing else. This must have been one hell of a honeymoon.
Back in Cairo, they were continuing their orgy of hedonistic excess when the black magic ritual in the Great Pyramid had an unexpected result that was to be the turning point in Crowley's life.
Rose got into a strange state of mind. I had never seen anything like it before. She kept on repeating, dreamily, yet intensely, "They are waiting for you. They are waiting for you."
When Crowley asked Rose who was waiting, she kept repeating that it was Horus, an Egyptian god. Crowley was puzzled and irritated by his wife's bizarre behavior. She knew nothing of magic and even less of Egyptology. Surely she, of all people, was not receiving a message from the gods. Crowley decided to take Rose down to the Egyptian Museum to test what she was saying. Rose had never visited the museum before. To Crowley's amazement, she rushed through rooms full of ancient artifacts until suddenly she stopped dead. There he is. It was an image of the same god she claimed to have seen in her vision. Crowley was stunned. What could this mean? Rose told him that they had to go back to the hotel room and wait to find out.
There seems to be that instance back in the museum in Cairo when he went to look at this exhibit, which was Exhibit 666, and after that getting in touch with somebody that said they were the god Horus. I think at that point something happened within his life. He opened himself up to a power that never ever left him, which he developed. And I believe he was the real thing. I believe that people that came into contact with him came into contact with that which was supernaturally evil. He had given himself under that demonic control, and that demonic control could now affect him and could work through him.
I shall find you, I shall have you, I am coming back to you.
Crowley was about to receive a revelation that would make him the prophet of a new religion, giving him a charter to pursue a life dedicated to sex and magic, no matter what the consequences. Alistair Crowley had delved deep into black magic, but in all the rituals he had performed, he had failed to communicate with a demonic entity. He believed that this was necessary to become a supreme master of the occult who could harness the powers of darkness. A room in Cairo, what he had been waiting for all his life, was about to happen. Crowley heard an unearthly voice from over his left shoulder. For 1 hour, at precisely the same time over the next 3 days, Crowley said that the voice dictated to him the Book of the Law, the work that would become the Bible of his new religion.
The Book of the Law, it just really is ripping up everything. It's ripping up the Bible, it's ripping up the Quran, you know, it's ripping up all the holy books and saying, we're starting fresh now. This is the word of the new eon. We're going to peck out the eyes of Christ on the cross. It's very, very blasphemous. It's all about liberation. It's all about having no restrictions at all. You follow your path, you follow your goal in life, and you do that above all else.
The Book of the Law is the Bible of the religion Crowley was endeavouring to found. A book of inspired writings, whereby Crowley portrays himself as a medium for some higher force. Inevitably, with an egomaniac like Crowley, he finds himself cast in the central role.
The Book of the Law states, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law." In other words, people have the right to determine exactly how to live their lives, regardless of moral and religious boundaries. Crowley saw himself as the prophet of this new creed, and a year later showed just how far he was prepared to take it when he set off to conquer one of the world's highest mountains. Crowley had started climbing as a teenager, scaling the perilous chalk cliffs of Beachy Head. In 1905, a year after the great revelation in Cairo, Crowley led the first attempt on the world's third highest mountain, Kanchenjunga. But the belief in the absolute supremacy of his will was to have terrible consequences.
Crowley was, in point of fact, a very good climber. He could have become known as one of the great climbers. But in this major expedition, the Kanchenjunga expedition, he deserted the rest of the party because they'd had some kind of a quarrel, and the quarrel was largely due to the fact that they didn't like the way that he tried to boss everybody around. And, of course, Crowley simply went off saying, "All right, you bastards, if you don't want me, then, you know, that's too bad."
The rest of the party was descending the mountain face when an avalanche struck. Crowley was alleged to have ignored the cries of the stricken men, preferring to stay in his tent, drinking tea. Four people were killed in the tragedy.
Crowley more or less saw what had happened and just let them die. Now, that's sort of really unpleasant, because he knew perfectly well, you know, that as a climber, it was his job to help them. And, of course, that finished him as far as the climbing world was concerned. From then on, he was untouchable.
Unmoved by the tragedy, Crowley set off on a trek across China with his wife Rose and their baby girl. Reaching Vietnam, he abandoned his wife and took up with a mistress back in Shanghai. Rose was unable to cope on her own, and the child died of typhoid. Crowley then deserted Rose for good, blaming her for the death. In despair, she went mad. Back in England, Crowley found his first disciple, Victor Neuberg, a young Cambridge poet.
In the case of Neuberg, there was definitely a peculiar kind of homosexual relation, and I'm not just now talking about the ordinary physical thing. Neuberg was in love with him. That's what I mean. He got mixed up with Crowley. Crowley saw there a far weaker character. Plunged on Neuberg, and of course dragged him into this whole business of black magic.
Neuberg was subjected to a series of sadistic acts designed to test the poet's dedication to the beast. The two set off to Algeria to perform Enochian magic, a dark and dangerous set of occult rituals. They walked deep into the Sahara for 2 days until they reached the point of exhaustion.
I think the reason for the desert is it's so desolate, it's so isolated, that there's nothing for your consciousness to latch onto. There are no markings, there's no change in the desert. And I think this beats your consciousness into a kind of a state of sensory deprivation. I think this is perfect for the sort of magic that Crowley was doing. This is what he wanted to do. And they really were stepping off into the unknown.
Disorientated by the effects of the desert and copious quantities of hashish and mescaline, Crowley and Neuberg embarked on the climax of the ritual, summoning Coronzon, the dweller of the abyss, seen within the occult world as the devil himself.
This particular ritual was extremely dangerous. Make no mistake, they were opening the gates of hell, the opening lines. And these words are literally to open the gates of hell.
He knew, and this sounds a weird thing to say, he knew that magic works. We don't believe in it nowadays, but in point of fact, all that you're really doing is trying to persuade forces that do exist outside this world to come into this world. And to do so, you have to serve as that passage yourself to a large extent. And that's the reason the magician gets inside a circle and stays inside the circle. Now, Crowley liked playing with fire. He drew the circle around Neuburg, and he himself was outside the circle. Well, magicians don't do that. It really is dangerous. You know, people can go mad. They suddenly hear voices inside their heads that they can't get rid of. Now, Crowley, fortunately, was such a bastard that he was more or less immune.
Crowley gets seized with a passion to perform a sexual act, and Crowley is the passive partner in the sex act. And at the point of orgasm, Crowley has like a mystic revelation. He sees a blinding white light. He seems to commune with the secret chiefs, and he suddenly realises that sex can be a sacrament, can be in praise of the gods. It's like a shortcut. It's a short circuit to go straight in to achieve whatever you want to achieve magically.
The effect of the rituals left Neuburg a shattered man. He never fully recovered from the experience. But for Crowley, this was the final piece in the jigsaw. He had now united his belief in the power of sex and magic into one occult vision.